strike popped out in Bazaire's system, and Esme oversaw the signal drop to Fleet Sector HQ. Scan reported no traces matching that of the Elias Madero. No other ship of that mass had been through in over 100 days, according to the station master. The agent from the Boros Consortium demanded an update on the investigation a short time later. Captain Solis requested a real-time link to Overhold and had the link transferred to his office. He asked his exec to sit in on the conference.
Not all of them.
I'm sorry. Apparently the ship was captured. There is evidence under imminent threat of heavy weapons. And although the crew had been promised safe exit in a lifeboat, they were instead killed.
The children?
We don't know. We found no children's bodies, and we know the crew had concealed them in one or more core compartments.
But who?
We don't know yet. We've sent the data we have back to headquarters. Someone will figure it out, I'm sure. Now, about the deceased.
You will, of course, release the remains to Boros Consortium for transmittal to the families.
I'm afraid we can't at this time. We have positively identified all adult crew personnel and one apprentice, but it's possible the bodies bear additional evidence of the perpetrators. We must continue to examine them.
But that's outrageous!
Ma'am, what was done to these people was outrageous. We must find out who did it so that we don't have more of this.
What was done? What was done?
There was mutilation, ma'am. And that's all I care to say until forensics is through with the remains. I can assure you that all due care will be taken to return remains to family members as soon as possible.
When the crew remains and the other debris had been transferred to the courier that would take it to Sector HQ, Shrike went back out on patrol.
We don't try to pursue?
No, not our job. We can't tangle with three-armed ships, and we have no idea where, besides Bazaire, that jump point leads. Someone's going to have to explore it blind. The trail's cold and growing colder. We did what we could. We have hull signatures on the raiders, or close to. We know what happened to the crew.
But not if there were weapons aboard.
No. But I'd say it was a fair bet that there were. We'll just have to keep eyes and ears open. You're asking good questions, though, Lieutenant Suiza.
Baron returned the sentry's salute as he came to the access area for the Jurfalcon. At last, he was going aboard a real warship, to a proper assignment. Not that he would have missed the time on Kosciusko and meeting Esme. He quickly turned his mind from that painful thought. Meeting her was one thing, but their relationship now was something he could have missed quite happily. But this, since he'd been out of the academy, this was his first regular assignment, and he was more than happy to get it. As he expected, when he reported aboard, he was called to the captain's cabin. Captain Escobar. He had looked Simon Escobar up in the captain's lists. Escobar was a commander with combat experience at Patchcock, Dartmouth, and Alvara. He had, besides an impressive array of combat decorations, the discreet jewels that denoted top rank in academic courses, ranging from his cadet days at the academy to the senior command and staff course.
Ensign Serrano. Always glad to have a Serrano aboard. I served under your uncle or great-uncle, I suppose. There are too many of you Serranos to keep straight.
Baron had heard that before, and the Escobars, though an old fleet family, had never had as many on active service at one time as the Serranos.
You've had an unusual set of assignments so far, I see. I hope you won't find us too mundane.
By no means, sir. I'm delighted to be here.
Good. We have only 3 other command track ensigns at the moment, all with a half-standard year on the ship.
Which meant they already knew things he would have to scramble to learn.
My exec is Lieutenant Commander Dockery. He has all your initial assignments.
Lieutenant Commander Dockery spent 5 minutes dissecting Baron's past career and preparation, pointed out that he was a half-year behind his peers, and then sent him on to Master Chief Zuckerman to get his ship tags, data cubes, and other necessities. Baron came out of Dockery's office wondering if Zuckerman was another step on the cut-the-ensigns-down-to-size production line. Master Chief Zuckerman nodded when Baron introduced himself.
I served with Admiral Vita Serrano on the Delphine, and you're her grandson, I understand?
Zuckerman was a big man, heavily built, who looked about 40. Rejuve, of course, No one made Master Chief by 40.
That's right, Chief.
Well, how may I help you, sir?
A lifetime's experience with the breed told Baron that the twinkle in Zuckerman's eye was genuine. For whatever mysterious reasons senior enlisted sometimes decided to like young officers, Zuckerman had decided to like him.
Commander Dockery told me to acquaint myself with the starboard watch orders.
Zuckerman fumbled a cube out of a file.
Yes, sir. Right here. This has your schematics, your billeting list, your duty stations. Now, you can either view it here or check it out. If you check it out, it's a level 2 security incident, and I'll require your signature on the paperwork.
I better check it out. I'm on duty 4 shifts from now, and I'm supposed to know it by then.
You'll do fine, sir.
Zuckerman rummaged a bit in a drawer and came up with an array of papers.
Captain likes hard copy on all checkouts of secured documents, so it really is paperwork.
Baron signed on the designated line, initialed in the spaces.
When do I have to have it back?
1400 tomorrow, sir.
Thanks, Chief.
Good to have you aboard, sir.
There were worse ways to start ship duty than by having a Master Chief for a friend. Baron went off to put his duffel in his quarters, considerably cheered. Young officers in command track were expected to know everything moderately well. Ensigns rotated through various systems and sections of the cruiser, learning by doing, or, as often, by making mistakes less critical at their level than later on. The other three ensigns aboard had all started at the bottom, environmental, and completed their 2-month rotation there. So Baron expected his first assignment, unaffectionately known as the Shit Scrubber Special.
Your nose is unreliable. You think it stinks, and it does stink, but your nose gets used to it. Use your badges and readouts. And anytime you're actually opening units, suit up. This stuff is deadly.
Baron wanted to ask why they weren't all dead then, but he knew better than to joke with someone like Jig Arundy. It was clear from her expression that she took sewage treatment very seriously, and, he suspected, spent every spare moment reading up on new technology. She led him through the system he would help maintain, explaining every color-coded pipe, every label, every gauge and dial. Then she turned him over to Scrubber Team 3 and told him to do a practice inspection of the system from intake 14 to outputs 12 to 15.
And you can't use that old saw about flagpoles. This is my test team, and they'll do exactly what and only what you tell them.
Baron shook his head, resigned, but started in. He remembered almost everything. He forgot to have them turn off the check valve between primary feed and the intermediate scrubbers, and Arundy gave him a grudging thumbs up. Then she spent 10 minutes with the flow diagrams explaining exactly why that check valve should be closed during routine inspections. In a few days, Baron felt he was fitting in well. All 4 command track ensigns bunked together. They were pleasant enough, and genuinely glad that someone else had the scrubber duty for the next 2 months. Meals in the junior wardroom enabled him to meet the other juniors, Jigs and lieutenants, who were his immediate superiors. Jig Arundy, he discovered, could talk about something other than sewage. She turned out to be an avid follower of celebrity news flashes. She and a handful of others discussed celebrities as if they were family members, endlessly poring over their clothes, their love affairs, their amusements. When she found he'd been at Copper Mountain with Brun Meager, she wanted to know all about it. Was she really as beautiful as her pictures? What kind of clothes did she wear? Had there been many news flash shooters around? Baron answered what he could, but luckily it did not occur to Arundy that he himself might have been a target of Brun's attention. When the wardroom discussions of Brun became uncomfortable, he took himself off. He would much rather listen to Zuckerman's tales of the old days in Delphine with his grandmother. She'd never told him about the time a missile hung in the tube with a live warhead. He mentioned that to Petty Light Harcourt while they were replacing a section of feeder pipe.
Zuckerman is... well, he's Zuckerman.
Baron was surprised at the tone.
It's like this, sir. Zuckerman's got a fine record, and I'm not saying anything against him. But he's changed in this last tour. He's not the man he was. We all know it, and we make allowances.
But allowance shouldn't have to be made, not for a Master Chief. Harcourt was still looking at him, and Baron realized he was expecting a comment.
Family?
It must have been the right thing to say, because Harcourt relaxed.
I wouldn't bring this up with a junior officer, begging your pardon, sir. But you are a Serrano, and, well, the chief's always talking about the time he served with the Serrano on Delphine. It's not anything I can understand. It's not all the time. Just sometimes. It's like he forgets things. The kind of thing you just don't forget. Not with his years. I have to have someone check his pressure suit settings, for instance. One emergency drill, he didn't even have his suit sealed.
Baron knew he shouldn't be hearing this. Someone considerably senior should be hearing this.
I did say something to Major Sertzi. He arranged to have the chief called in for a random health survey, but, well, that was one of his good days. And on his good days, he's sharpening an iron. And then the major was reassigned, and I was just... I don't quite know how far to take this.
So the sticky problem had just been handed off to a very junior ensign, with the Serrano reputation. No good to tell Harcourt that he didn't feel comfortable with it either. The job description for ensigns did not include comfort.
And you'd like me to take this on upstairs?
Well, it's up to you, sir. Although, if I could make a suggestion.
Sure.
Having hooked the ensign, of course the petty light could play him.
Commander Dockery prefers to have, well, all the ducks in a row, sir, if you know what I mean.
In other words, I should investigate this myself and have some documentation.
Well, yes, sir.
Baron would have to have something, that was certain. Something more than the word of a petty light who might have some grievance Baron didn't know about.
I'll have a look.
Harcourt looked satisfied with that. Baron himself had no idea how to go about finding out if a senior NCO was going bonkers for some reason. He remembered what Brunn had said about that man at the schools. What was his name? She'd claimed he was making too many mistakes, but that was right before she and Esme had the big fight. Baron had no idea what had happened after that, if anyone else had confirmed Brunn's suspicions. Still, he paid close attention to Zuckerman every time his own duties took him that way. The man seemed much like every other Master Chief he'd met. Decades of experience providing him with a depth of knowledge and competence far beyond the ability of an ensign to assess. Zuckerman could be missing whole chunks and he'd never know it. He liked Zuckerman, and Zuckerman seemed to like him. He hoped he wouldn't find anything to worry about. He worried that he might miss something important. But most of the time, he was too busy to worry, too busy to find time to visit Zuckerman. He had watches to stand, inspections to take, duties that kept him busy. He had peers, the other ensigns in both command and technical tracks, whose personalities and relationships became ever more important as time went on. He tried not to think of Esme. As time wore on, he could not stay angry, but he remained confused. They had liked each other a lot back on Kosciusko. They had shared secrets neither had told anyone else. He had expected her to welcome his presence at Copper Mountain, and granting that she had been extremely busy and tired, there was still something else different about her, a new reserve, a tension. And then there had been Brunn, always around when he wanted to talk to Esme, always with time on her hands. Exuberant when Esme was reserved, jolly when Esme was serious, fun when Esme was, he would not say dull, because to him she was never dull, but busy, tired, not really present when she was sitting right beside him. Perhaps she never had loved him. Perhaps it had worn off and she was too kind to say so. That didn't make sense, though, if she was angry because she thought Brunn had enticed him into her bed. He thought of sending mail, but after all, their quarrel wasn't his fault. As he came to know the other junior officers better, he noticed that he kept running into one in particular, Cassie Ferrati. He'd heard of Cassie Ferrati back at the academy, but she'd graduated before he started. He knew how rumors grow with time and assumed that the stories of her beauty and her behavior were both inflated. Baron first noticed Lieutenant Ferrati because of her hair, that uncommon golden blonde, like Brunn's, but different. Brunn's hair had a life of its own. It curled vigorously, even when just groomed, and when she was upset or excited and raked her fingers through the curls, it looked like an uncombed poodle. Lieutenant Faradi's hair lay in a sleek wave beside her perfect cheekbones. Blondes were rare in Fleet. Perhaps that accounted for Lieutenant Faradi's nickname, Goldie, which he heard in the junior wardroom the first night. He noticed her next because she kept showing up where he was and speaking to him. She was a jig on the watch rotation, so of course she would be where he was part of the time, but he began to realize that he saw her more than any other jig, even when she wasn't on shift watch. He hadn't thought about her being in Esme's class at the academy until she brought it up while initialing the mid-watch report.
You know Lieutenant Suizan, don't you, Ensign?
Yes, sir.
I wonder if she's changed much. We were classmates, you know.
No, sir, I didn't know that.
Faradi fiddled with the data wand.
I mean, she was such a stiff, formal person. Not really friendly. But from what everyone says, she's such a born leader. So I was wondering.
Tiny alarm bells rang in Baron's back brain, but his forebrain was ahead of them.
She's fairly formal, yes, but I believe it has something to do with her background.
Oh, yes. Both of us were the colonial outcasts, you know. I'm Crescent Worlds. I think they expected me to insist on wearing one of those trailing silk things.
Faradi's hands fluttered and waved. Baron had no idea what she meant, and his expression must have showed it.
Oh, I guess you haven't seen the bad story cubes about us. I think they got the costumes from back on old Earth, because, of course, no one actually wears them. Long, flowing garments that cover young women from head to toe, but flutter fetchingly in the breeze.
Baron had no time to pick out what detail had set off the alarms again.
But Esme, Lieutenant Suiza, she told me once her whole family was military, very formal, very correct, which is why I can understand her having a quarrel with the Speaker's daughter, but not how she could lead anyone anywhere.
I didn't know the quarrel was common knowledge.
I don't see how anyone could keep it quiet. It was on the news flashes, after all. Screamed like a harpy, is what I heard. And told the Speaker's daughter she had no more morals than a tavern whore.
It wasn't like that.
Faradi looked at him with an indulgent smile that made him feel like a small child.
That's all right, Ensign. I'm not asking you to turn your back on a Fleet hero.
Faradi made him feel uncomfortable. She was always looking at him. He would glance up and discover those clear, violet eyes and an amused quirk to her mouth. She seemed to impinge on his space in a way that Esme never did. Brunn, though she had been overtly interested in his body, had backed off without rancor when refused. But this... He went into the gym, convinced that whatever was going on was his fault. He had done something, what he couldn't figure out, that aroused her interest. He climbed onto the exercise machine he'd reserved and set the controls. Past the warm-up phase, into the sweaty part of the workout, his mind drifted to Esme. She was exec of a specialty ship now. He could imagine her in a rescue situation. She might do something spectacular and get back in everyone's good graces.
Hello, Ensign.
There beside him on the next machine was Faradi. Baron blinked, confused. She hadn't been signed up for that machine. He'd made sure of that. But now she was warming up, her body as sleek as her golden hair, in a shiny exercise suit that outlined every curve. Baron nodded a greeting. Faradi started her own machine.
You're a hard worker. I guess that goes with being a Serrano, eh?
He had to say something. She was still looking at him, and it would be rude to ignore her, possibly even insubordinate.
It's expected, sir.
No need for formality in the gym. I approve of the attitude and the results, Baron.
Her look ranged over him with particular attention he couldn't mistake. Well, he would have to say something. But before he could, Major Oslon climbed onto the machine on Faradi's other side.
Hey, Cassie, let Serrano finish his workout. He's too young for you anyway. I, on the other hand...
Faradi gave Baron a last lingering look before turning to Oslon.
Why, Major, you're incorrigible. What makes you think I'm after Ensign Serrano?
Glad to know you're not. I must have been misled by the fit of that exercise suit.
This whole thing?
Baron had seen less obvious flirting from professionals at the trade, but Aslan didn't seem to mind. He and Cassie bantered a while, and when he invited her to a game of parpon, she agreed, with a last lingering look at Baron that bothered him all over again. A few days later, Baron was on his way through troop deck on a routine inspection of the traps in the heads. Hairballs in the traps were a constant problem.
What the...
He looked around, trying to locate the sound, slightly behind him and to the right. After a few moments, he pinpointed the source, D-82. Baron looked in to see Master Chief Zuckerman, face almost purple with rage and exertion, dragging someone by the heels.
Chief, what's going on?
Out of my way!
Zuckerman did not seem to recognize him. His eyes were dilated.
Chief!
Baron could not see clearly past him, but the limpness of the leg Zuckerman held bothered him. He lifted his gaze a little, down the row of racks to one with a depression where someone had been sitting, a needler case on the pillow.
Chief, put that down!
Baron had no idea what had happened, but it was trouble all the same. He reached back for the alarm beside the hatch.
Oh, no you don't, you puppy!
Zuckerman dropped the man's feet and charged. Baron ducked aside, and Zuckerman kept going, bouncing off the opposite bulkhead. By then, Baron had slapped the alarm, cutting in local scan.
Security! ASAP! Man down! Possible assault!
Zuckerman turned, more slowly than he'd charged.
Not possible. That bastard attacked me. Me, a Master Chief with 20... He shouldn't have done that. Not right.
Chief, what happened?
None of your lip, boy. What the devil are you doing wearing officer's insignia? That's illegal. You want to get tossed out? You take those pings off your uniform this minute, Pivot.
Master Chief Zuckerman, I asked you a question.
Zuckerman stared at him, his face blanking a moment.
Ensign Serrano, what's that you were asking me, sir?
Baron wondered where security was, what was taking them so long.
Chief, I'm watch officer today. I heard something funny and came to look. You're in 82, dragging someone, and there's a needler case on a rack.
Zuckerman stepped forward, but Baron put up his hand.
No, don't go in there. Security's on the way. I want nothing disturbed. Can you tell me what happened?
Zuckerman was sweating now, his face shiny with it. His hands opened and closed rhythmically.
He was gonna kill me. He pulled a needler. He said he'd never be caught.
Zuckerman shook his head, then looked at Baron again.
Son of a bitch. Actually tried it. If I didn't have good reflexes, I'd be dead in there. So I grabbed his hand and got the needler and hit.
He turned pale and sagged against the bulkhead.
I hit him and then...
Chief, stay where you are. Can you do that?
Yes, sir. But I don't know.
Just stay there. I need to check the guy. What's his name?
Moradon. Corporal Moradon.
All right, I'm going in. I want you to stay exactly where you are.
Moradon lay where Zuckerman had dropped him, unmoving. Baron stepped closer. Now he could see the bruises and blood on the man's head, and a long streak of blood on the deck where he'd been dragged. Baron couldn't tell if he was breathing. He knelt beside the limp body. Through the open mouth, he could just feel the moist breath against the back of his hand. He stood up and went back to the corridor. Zuckerman stood where he'd been told, and down the corridor came a security team with medical assist.
Sir?
The sergeant in charge's gaze flicked quickly from Baron to Zuckerman, down to Zuckerman's hands, back to his face, and Baron could see the puzzlement in his eyes.
There's a man down in 82, head injuries, but he's breathing. You'll need to secure the area for forensic examination and look for a loose needler.
The sergeant waved the medical team forward and gave the necessary orders to his team. Then he glanced at Baron again.
Did the man in there attack Chief Zuckerman, sir, or you?
If you please, Sergeant, just see to it that the area is secured and that the injured man is treated appropriately.
Yes, sir.
Before the sergeant could comment, Baron turned to Zuckerman.
Chief, I need you to come with me to make a report. Can you do that?
Of course, sir. What's the problem?
Baron wished he had an answer for that.
We'll let the exec sort it out.
It occurred to him, as he led the way back up to command deck, that perhaps he should have brought along an escort. What if Zuckerman got violent again? Surely he wouldn't, but all the way up to command deck, his neck prickled at the thought of Zuckerman behind him. He met Lieutenant Commander Dockery coming down the ladder from command deck and came to attention.
What is it, Ensign?
Sir, we have a real problem. Permission?
Go ahead. Wait, who's that with you?
Chief Zuckerman, sir. There's been an incident.
I know you called for security. At ease, both of you. Spit it out then, Ensign.
Baron spit it out, aware all the time of Zuckerman, his age, his seniority, his record, standing there looking entirely too confused still. Dockery glanced at Zuckerman.
Well, Chief?
Commander, I don't know quite what happened.
Did this individual attack you?
I think so. Yes, sir. He did. I can almost see it.
Dockery gave Baron a look he could not interpret.
Did you do anything with the chief, Ensign?
No, sir.
Was he sedated by security?
No, sir.
You came up here with someone you're accusing of assault without sedating him or putting him under guard?
Sir, he'd calmed down. He wasn't...
Dockery touched one of the comm panels on the bulkhead.
Exo to med. Stat response team to my location. Ensign, the chief is clearly not himself. He needs medical evaluation prior to anything else.
I feel fine, Commander.
Indeed, Zuckerman looked like the model of a master chief.
I'm sorry to have upset the ensign. I'm not sure why...
Just routine, Chief. Just a checkup. Make sure you aren't coming down with something.
A team of medics arrived, carrying crash kits.
Chief Zuckerman's had a little spell of confusion this morning. Why don't you take him down to sick bay and check him out? He might need a little something to calm him.
There's nothing wrong with me.
Baron noticed Zuckerman's neck flushing again. He stared at Baron and saluted stiffly.
I'm sorry, Admiral.
Baron felt a coldness settle into his belly. He returned the salute, just to get Zuckerman to relax.
Whatever you say, Admiral.
Just a checkup.
Baron was afraid to let his gaze wander to see how Commander Dockery was taking this. Zuckerman was staring at him with an expression halfway between fear and awe.
It'll be fine, Chief.
By your leave, sir.
Go along, then.
The medics led Zuckerman off with the obvious care of professionals ready to leap into action.
Well, Ensign, you've made a fine mess of things, haven't you?
Baron knew better than to protest that it wasn't his fault.
I know I did something wrong, Commander, but I'm not sure what I should have done.
Come along and I'll tell you as we go. Down on troop deck, wasn't it?
Dockery strode off, leaving Baron to follow.
And just how much of Zuckerman's problem did you know about?
Me, sir? Not much. Another NCO had said something, but he said it had been checked by another officer and nothing was found.
Did you look for anything, or did you just ignore it?
I looked, sir, but I didn't know what to look for. The times I talked to him, Chief Zuckerman seemed fine to me. Well, there was once, but it didn't seem that important.
Baron began to see the shape of his sin looming ahead.
And you didn't see fit to pass on what this other NCO told you?
Sir, I wanted to have something definite before bothering you.
I'm just as unhappy to be bothered with trifles as anyone else, Ensign. But I'm even more unhappy to be bothered with a large problem that someone let get big because he didn't know what to do about it.
I should have told you right away, sir.
Yes. And if I chewed on you for bringing me vague, unsubstantiated reports, well, that's what ensigns are for. To provide jaw exercise for grumpy executive officers. If you told me, or this other mysterious NCO had told me, and who was that, by the way?
Petty Light Harcourt, sir.
I thought Harcourt had better sense. Who'd he tell before?
A Major Surtsey, who was transferred out. He said they'd done a med check and found nothing.
I remember. Pete told me about that before he left, but said he hadn't found anything definite. He said I'd keep my eye out, thinking my officers would have the good sense to pass on anything they heard.
Sorry, sir.
Well, all you youngsters make mistakes, but mistakes have consequences. In this case, if I'm not mistaken, the ruin of a good man's career.
They were on troop deck now, and Dockery led the way to the right passage and compartment as if he never needed to stop and think. Baron supposed he didn't. The security team had cordoned off the passage, and as Dockery arrived, so did a forensics team.
Commander, all right to go on and start collecting evidence?
If it's been scanned. Come on, Ensign. I want to show you how to do this.
If Baron had not been so aware of his failings, it would have been a fascinating hour. But it was followed quickly by a less pleasant time in Dockery's office.
Remember, the chewing out you get for bothering me with a non-problem will never be as big as the one you get for not bothering me with a real problem.
Yes, sir.
Unless Zuckerman turns out to have an unsuspected medical problem, and anything big enough to excuse this would probably get him a medical out, he's in big trouble.
Something tickled a corner of Baron's mind.
sir?
Yes?
Something I just remembered, sir, about another senior NCO back at Copper Mountain.
Relevant to this?
It might be, sir, but it's not something I observe myself. It's just that when you said medical problem...
Go on, Ensign.
Baron related the story of the Master Chief whose crew was covering up for some strange memory lapses as succinctly as possible.
And, sir, back on Kosciusko, I remember being told that the Master Chief in the infantry had had a breakdown after the battle. Everyone was surprised because he'd been in combat before, but he wasn't directly involved anyway.
And you're wondering what affected three Master Chiefs. Do you have any idea how many Master Chiefs there are in the whole regular space service?
No, sir.
Of course, by the time they're Master Chiefs, most of the problem cases have been eliminated. But it is odd. I'll tell the medics and see if anyone has any ideas.
But Baron's sins had earned him yet another chewing out, this time at the captain's hands.
Ensign, Commander Dockery has had his chance at your backside. Now it's my turn. But first, let's see if you understand what you did wrong, or rather, didn't do right.
Yes, sir. I knew about a problem and did not keep Commander Dockery or you advised.
Because?
Because I thought I should gather more data, keep a record of incidents, before telling anyone else.
I see. Serrano, there are several possible motives for that action, and I want a straight answer out of you. Were you trying to protect Chief Zuckerman's reputation or get yourself a bit of glory by bringing me a nice juicy bone?
Sir, I think I was confused at first. I was surprised when the other NCO told me about Zuckerman. But when he said he'd reported it before and that a major had taken it seriously, I thought it might be a real problem. Except that medical hadn't found anything. I didn't know why the NCO had confided in me in particular. It made me uncomfortable. So I thought I'd keep an eye out and document anything I noticed.
And did you notice anything?
Not anything I could put a finger on, sir. There was less respect for Chief Zuckerman than I would expect to find among enlisted, but not enough to be insubordination. I noticed that he was not intervening in some situations where I'd have expected his influence. But he'd made only two actual errors that I documented. And even Master Chiefs are human. I didn't want to go around asking questions. He deserved better than that.
Wait there. You're telling me you made the judgment. That you felt qualified to make the judgment. That Zuckerman deserved better than you asking questions about him. Zuckerman likes you, that much is clear. Were you swayed by his favoritism to your family, or were you just out of your depth completely?
Sir, I know that I was out of my depth, but I didn't recognize that at the time.
I see. Then you thought you'd keep a quiet eye on him, document any problems, and bring your report to... Exactly who did you expect to bring this report to? Assuming you came up with something.
Under that cool, gray gaze, Baron's mind kept trying to blank out. But a lifetime's experience gave him the right answer even in his panic.
To Chief Zuckerman's commander in the chain, sir, which would be Lieutenant Commander Orstein.
That much is correct. And what did you expect to happen when you presented such a report?
Sir, I thought Commander Orstein would review it, perhaps make his own investigation, and then take whatever action he felt necessary.
And it would be out of your hands?
Yes, sir.
And what did you think Orstein would do with you, the pup who dragged in this unsavory prize?
I hadn't thought about that, sir.
Oh, I find that hard to believe.
Sir, no one could be happy to find a Master Chief losing effectiveness, sir. Master Chiefs are special.
Yes, they are. So if I read between the lines correctly, you figured Lieutenant Commander Orstein would chew you out and then maybe undertake his own investigation.
Yes, sir.
Tell me, Serrano, if you had found additional problems, are you certain you'd have risked the chewing out to report on Zuckerman?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's something. Let me reiterate what I'm sure Dockery told you. It is annoying for a junior to show no initiative and bother a senior with minor problems. But It is dangerous and, in the long run, disloyal for a junior to conceal a serious problem from a senior. If you had reported this sooner, Chief Zuckerman's problems, whatever they are, could have been dealt with properly in the chain of command. And I would not have been caught flat-footed and embarrassed. I presume you understand this, and I presume you won't do it again. And if you do, the trouble you're in now will be as a spark compared to a nuclear explosion. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Then get out of here and do better.
Lieutenant Cassie Ferrati knew she looked like a recruiting poster. She intended to. Every hair on her head lay exactly where it should, and under perfectly arched brows, her violet eyes sparkled with intelligence. Her features, strong cheekbones and clean-cut jawline, short straight nose, and firm but generous lips, fit anyone's image of professional beauty. It had been worth the risk of early biosculpt. All she had ever wanted was to be a fleet officer. No, to be honest, a fleet commander. She had first imagined herself in command of a starship when only a child, her parents had told her. Cassie Ferrati was born to be a hero, born to prove that a Crescent Worlds woman could do anything. Her parents had been shocked when she told them what she wanted. But at 10, even girls could speak to the sept as a whole, not just parents, about important decisions like marriage negotiations. She had taken her argument to the aunt's gossip, where her desire to go off-world was quickly approved. She was too intelligent by far to fare well in the local marriage market. Biosculpting, though, it wasn't until her father's mother approved that she knew she had a chance. 3 years of surgery, of the pain that strengthening her redesigned body caused her, and then she took the fleet entrance exams, passed them, and left home forever. Once at the academy, Cassie discovered that her new shape was not considered sexless and unfeminine by her peers. Protected by the standard implant provided all academy cadets, she moved from interest to experimentation, and from experimentation to enthusiastic activity. She was angered, rather than alarmed, to discover that some of her classmates were making snide remarks about her behavior. But after graduation, she slowed down. Sex itself was no longer as exciting, and began to consider her targets with more care. In her first assignment, she discovered that if she stayed away from men already considered taken by other women, she could hunt at will without arousing comment. So that had been it. Testing this understanding, she turned her violet eyes on a lonely Jig, who was quite happy to console himself with a lovely ensign. But he wasn't enough. She wanted someone in command track. All the command track Jigs aboard were paired already, and she was not attracted to the single male lieutenant. A major? Could she? She did not doubt her ability to get his interest, but regulations were supposed to prevent him from dallying with junior officers in his chain of command. So she looked elsewhere, which led her to a major in another branch of technical track. He was followed by a lieutenant in command track, and then by another major. She learned something from each about the extent of her talent, and what advantages could come from such close associations. Now, though, she had found the right man. Against all expectations, she had found a respectable, intelligent, charming young man whom even her father would consider eligible. That he was an ensign and she a lieutenant meant nothing to her. He was mature for his age, and best of all, he was a Serrano. Family is everything, she had heard all her life, and better family than Serrano she could not hope to find. The only snag was that rumor said he was, or had been, interested in Esme Suiza. Cassie discounted that. At the academy, Esme had been a non-entity, even aside from being a prig. Not pretty, with a haphazard set of features topped with fluffy flyaway hair of nondescript brown. The boy had hero worship, that's all it was. And now, if rumor were true, Suiza was in trouble for being untactful. Cassie could believe that, no question. If she ever had a lover, which didn't seem likely, it would be someone as unspectacular as herself, another non-entity. probably just as tactless and doomed to as inglorious a career. Still, Esme's present disgrace would make it easier for Cassie to pursue Baron Serrano unhindered. And surely that Serrano grandmother wouldn't want him connected to someone like the bad Lieutenant Suiza. It would take very little, Cassie thought, to make absolutely sure that no one ever admired Lieutenant Suiza again. It was getting harder to get up off the floor to use the toilet. Brun realized that, in addition to the pregnancy, she was getting weaker because she didn't exercise much. The compartment would have been small for one person. With an adult woman, a girl, and two small children, it was impossibly crowded. And at any time, one of the men might look in. She could imagine how they would react if they caught her doing real exercises. She tried to make herself pace back and forth, but she quickly ran out of breath and leaned on the bulkhead, panting. The girl watched her with a worried frown, but looked away when Brun tried to smile at her. As Brun had shared more of the work, the girl had accepted that help, but always with reserve. That night, when the lights dimmed, signaling a sleep period, the girl slept at her back, curled around her. Brun woke to a breath of air in her ear. She started to lift her head and felt a gentle push downward.
Elias Madeiro, Merchanter.
Brun squirmed as if trying to find a comfortable position. Merchanter. The Merchanter ship. This girl must be off that ship. Excitement coursed through her. She knew something now.
I'm Hazel.
Then the girl squirmed as if moving in her sleep and rolled away. The rush of joy from those five words burst through Brun. This must have been how Lady Cecilia felt when she first made contact with the world again. A wave of shame followed. Lady Cecilia had been locked in paralysis and apparent coma for months, and months more of painful rehab, and she had been old. Brun was young, healthy.
I am not defeated. I am only detained on the way to victory. So I might bear children for these animals, so I might be a prisoner for months, for years. In the end, I am who I am, and that will not change.
She rolled over with difficulty and looked through narrowed lids at the girl, at Hazel. She had been impressed before at the girl's patience, her consistent gentleness with the little girls, her endless invention of quiet little games and activities to amuse them. But she had given up hoping for any real contact after the first long stretch of days. The girl was too scared. Now she appreciated the courage of this thin, overworked, terrified girl, still a child herself, who cared for two younger children and Brun, who dared, in the face of threats, to say a few words of comfort. She had lost everything, too. Parents, most likely. Were these children even her sisters? Maybe not, but no one could have done more for them. She pushed herself up to use the toilet. On the way back, she noticed that Hazel had rolled over again, as if offering Brun a niche convenient to her ear. Brun lay down, grunting, and pretended to sleep. Her arm slid sideways, touched Hazel's. She twisted. She was uncomfortable, and traced the letters of her name on Hazel's arm before moving her arm away. Hazel turned, burying her face under her hair.
Brun?
Brun nodded. A wave of excitement ran through her. The baby kicked vigorously as if aware of it. Someone besides the men knew who she was, an ally. She had made contact. It wasn't much, but it gave her hope, the first real hope she'd had. The next day, she watched Hazel covertly. The girl seemed the same as always, busy, careful, quiet, patient, warm with the children, and remote with Brun. When Brandy's restlessness grew toward a tantrum, Hazel intervened, steadied her, and Brun was reminded of an expert trainer with a fractious young horse. When she thought of it that way, she began to grasp how Hazel was using the children's need to steady herself. She could be calm, she could follow the senseless rules, because she had someone for whom she was responsible.
And who is my responsibility?
The words she had heard from Lieutenant Commander Euless came back to her. If she had been a regular Space Service officer, her duty would have been clear: to escape. Or if that was not possible, to live, gathering information until she could escape. But she wasn't. And even if she had been, even if she pretended to be, was that duty enough to sustain a lifetime such as she faced? What if she never had a chance to escape? The baby inside her moved, as if it were doing a tumbling act. Surely one baby couldn't make that much disturbance. Some people would say that it was her responsibility, but she did not feel that. It had been forced onto her, into her, and it was not hers at all. It was an abomination, as the men claimed she was.
Am I then my own responsibility?
Brun's mouth soured. Not enough to make a lifetime as a slave tolerable or even bearable. She had spent too many hours already planning how she could escape life, if not these men, once they lowered their guard. Eventually they would. But what if there were a chance, however slim, to keep Hazel and the little girls from her own fate? Somewhere, she was sure, her father was searching. Fleet was searching. It might be years. It might be too many years. But it might not. Hazel was compliant, not entirely from fear, but also from hope. The hope that some help might come. If she had not had some hope, she would never have dared share her name or her ship's name with Brun. So she, Brunhilde Charlotte Meager, could fix her mind on Hazel and the little girls, on saving them. She did not let herself think again about how unlikely success was. Instead, she began thinking what information she needed and how to get it. And she quit trying to catch Hazel's eye, quit trying to entice her into communication. The last thing she wanted now was trouble for Hazel. Only a few days later, the men came for both of them, and the little ones. Brun almost panicked. Had they realized Hazel had talked to her? That she had written her own name on Hazel's arm? But they were led along corridors, farther than Brun had ever gone. Her bare feet were sore. Her pregnancy made her awkward at the hatches. To her surprise, the men were patient, waiting while she lifted one leg, then the other. They helped her down a slanting surface to a space that opened out around her. She looked, her eyes unaccustomed to the distances after those months in the compartment. The docking bay of a space station, it looked like. All around were men, only men. She and Hazel and the two little girls were the only females. The men guided her, gently enough, to a hover chair. With Hazel walking beside her, the men pushed her chair a long distance. Chair and all, she was moved through another docking bay into a shuttle. Only five men now. At their command, Hazel strapped the children into seats and herself into another. The men locked the hover chair down. When the shuttle hatch opened, Brun smelled what could only be a planet. Fresh air, growing things, animals. Hope rose in her again. Planets were big. If she could once get loose, she could find a way to hide and then to escape. But right now, she could barely stand in this gravity, and the heat almost took her breath away. The men moved her hover chair from the shuttle through a low-ceilinged, box-like building, and then into a wheeled vehicle, also large and box-like, where they locked the chair down again. It had no windows in back, but up front she could see out, until a partition rose to cut off her vision. Panic choked her. She was alone in that back compartment. Hazel, the only person she knew, hadn't come with her. Hazel wouldn't know where she was. No one would know. She was going to be lost forever. Hazel watched under lowered lids as they took the pregnant woman away in a ground car. She still wasn't sure of the woman's name, even though the woman had traced it into her arm. Could Brun be right? What kind of name was that? A nickname for something, most likely. But they had not dared talk enough to make sure. Her yellow hair shone in the sun of this planet, much longer than it had been when Hazel had first seen her.
I'm taking the children.
The other men nodded and moved away.
Come along, girlie.
Hazel followed him, a little breathless with the unaccustomed exercise and the oppressive heat, Brandy holding one hand and Stassi the other. She wondered where the boys were. She hadn't seen them for a long time. She wondered even more about Stinky and pushed that thought aside, too. The man led them through a gate and across a wide, paved space so hot her feet burned. The little girls began to lag. The man turned.
Here, I'll carry them.
He scooped them up. They stiffened, turning their faces to Hazel.
Only a little farther.
Hazel stepped as lightly as she could. He stopped at last, beside a row of ground cars. A strip of something soft lay there.
Stand on that.
Hazel stepped onto it, and it was cool beneath her feet. He put the little girls down, and they each grabbed a hand. He punched something on a control panel set on a post, and one of the ground cars popped its doors. The man got in, fiddled with the controls, then put his head back out.
All of you, into the back.
Hazel pushed the little girls into the back of the ground car. It was soft inside, with cool air coming out of vents. After she climbed in, the door closed without her touching it. She noticed that there were no door handles on the inside, either.
I'm taking you home for now.
The car moved off. Hazel looked out the windows, but they were frosted, so she couldn't see. Between the back seat and the front, a dark panel had risen so that she couldn't see out the front, either. The car moved smoothly, though, with no sudden jerks. After some time, the car stopped, and the man opened the door from the outside.
Come along now. Be good.
They were on a wide, paved street between stone buildings, perhaps two stories tall, with a park of some kind just down the block. Hazel caught a glimpse of bright flowers arranged in some sort of pattern, but dared not take a real look. Instead, she followed the man across a stone-flagged walk to the entrance of the nearest building. A heavy carved door opened by a shorter man wearing white trousers and overshirt. Her escort led them into the house, down a hall, into a large room with big windows opening on a garden. He pointed to a place near the door.
Wait here.
Hazel stood, holding the little girls to her. He walked across the room and sat in a chair that faced the door. A girl about Hazel's age, wearing a plain brown dress, scurried into the room, carrying a tray with a pitcher of some liquid and a tall mug. Hazel noticed that she kept her eyes lowered, moving with quick, short steps that didn't stretch her ankle-length skirt. Hazel did not dare to watch her all the way to the man's chair. The girl left, her busy feet slipping hurriedly past Hazel. Did she look at Hazel? The littles were looking at her. Hazel squeezed their shoulders in warning. As the legs flashed past her, bare to the knee, in sandals, Hazel realized it must be a boy.
Daddy! You're home!
Hey, pard. Were you good? Did you take care of your mother?
Yes, sir.
That's my boy.
Hazel saw the small bare feet of three girls, the slim skirts that hobbled their ankles, and, so astonishing she almost forgot and lifted her eyes, a woman's feet angled up on high, pointed heels beneath full skirts. The girls rushed forward. The woman strode. Hazel peeked through lowered lids to see a child hardly bigger than Brandy throw herself at her father's lap.
Daddy!
A larger girl, head down, moved up to nestle against his side. One, still larger, moved to his other side. The man kissed each girl.
Mwah. Mwah.
Hazel wanted to cry. She could feel the littles trembling. They wanted a cuddle, too. They would break away any moment now. She clutched at them harder.
I brought you something. Look at there.
Hazel could feel, as if it were sunlight, their gazes on her and the littles.
Found them on a merchanter we captured. The girlie's a bit old, but biddable. Been no trouble. The two little ones, well, one of them's too talkative. We'll just have to see. You take them on back and get them settled. Girlie's a virgin, all right. Doc checked.
Hazel saw the wide skirt, a wife's skirt, and then a firm hand on her shoulder, pushing. She obeyed, walking ahead of the woman, bringing the littles with her. She had no idea what was coming.
You can look at me in here.
Hazel looked up. The woman had a broad, peaceful-looking face, with a crown of gray-brown hair in a braid above it. She had big, broad hands and a big, broad body.
Let's see you, honey. Well, that's the ugliest dress I ever did see.
Hazel said nothing. She wasn't about to get into trouble if she could help it.
Didn't your folks teach you anything about sewing?
Hazel shook her head.
You can talk, too, as long as you keep it low, no hollering.
I don't know how to sew.
Hazel's voice felt stiff. It had been so long since she said a whole sentence.
Well, you just have to learn. You can't go around looking like that, not in this family.
Hazel bobbed her head. Brandy tugged on her hand.
Hungry.
The woman looked down at the littles, her face creased with something Hazel could not read.
These little'uns yours? Sisters?
No.
No, ma'am. Didn't your folks teach you any manners?
No, ma'am.
Well, I sure will. Now let me think. You little'uns will fit into Mary Lou and Sally Ann's things, but you, girlie, phew, we have to find a name for you, too.
My name's Hazel.
Not anymore. Your old life is gone, and your old name with it. You put off the works of the devil and the devil's name. You will put on a godly name when we find the right one.
In the next weeks, Hazel settled into a life as far from her experience as the Raider's ship had been. She slept in a room with 10 other girls, all near or just past puberty, but unmarried. It was called the Virgin's Bower. Their room opened onto a tiny courtyard separated from the main garden by a stone screen and walled off from anything but their room. The room's other entrance was to a long corridor that led back to the main house without passing any other door. The first evening, one of the other girls helped Hazel unroll her bedding onto a wooden bunk, helped her straighten the cover properly.
So we're safe.
These were all, she discovered, daughters of the man who had brought her here. Daughters of four wives who had produced all the other children in the house. Only the children of his first wife were permitted in the great room, and only when he summoned them. The others, when he wanted to see them, went to the second parlor.
Y'all are the first outlanders in our household. Can't no one have outlanders unless they got enough children to dilute the influence of y'all's heathen ways.
So we can teach you right from wrong.
In short order, Hazel was clad in the same snug long skirt and long-sleeved top as the others. She learned to shuffle in quick steps. She learned how to navigate the corridors and rooms of the big house that seemed to sprawl on forever. She learned to stand aside respectfully when the boys ran down the hall, to duck her chin so that even the little boys, looking up, did not meet her gaze. Once a day, she was allowed to sit with Brandy and Stassi, if all her work was done. At first, they ran to her and clung, silent, crying into her shoulder. But as the days passed, they adjusted to whatever their life was like. She had asked, but they found it hard to tell her. And no wonder. They had been hardly able to talk clearly when the ship was taken, and too many things had happened. They had eaten honey cakes, or they had new dresses, was all they could say. At least they were being fed and cared for. And they had a little time each day to play in the garden. She saw them with the other small girls, tossing back and forth weighted streamers of bright colors. Her work was hard. The other girls her age were accomplished seamstresses, able to produce long, smooth, straight seams. They all knew how to cut cloth and shape garments. Now they were learning embroidery, cutwork, lacework, and other fine needlework. Hazel had to master plain knitting, crochet, and spend hours hemming bedsheets and bath towels. Besides sewing, she was taught cooking. To the wives' horror, she did not even know how to peel potatoes or chop carrots.
Imagine letting a poor girl grow up knowing so little. What do they expect you to do, child? Marry a man so rich and dissolute he would expect your servants to do everything.
We had machines.
Prima shook a finger at Hazel.
Best forget about machines, girl. The devil's ways. Making idle hands and giving women ideas. No machines here. Just honest women doing women's work the way it should be done.
Tertia bowed as she offered a bowl.
A touch more pot herb, my dear, but otherwise quite satisfactory.
Hazel had to admit that the kitchen smelled better than any ship's galley she'd ever been in. Every day, fresh bread from the big brick ovens. Every day, fresh food prepared from the produce of the garden. And she liked chopping carrots, even onions, better than those long, straight seams. The women even laughed, here by themselves, and softly. but they laughed. Never at the men, though. None of the jokes she'd heard all her life, bantering between the men and women of the crew. She wanted to ask why. She had 1,000 questions, 1,000,000. But she'd already noticed that girls didn't ask questions except about their work. How to do this, when to do that. And even then, they were often told to pay better attention. She did her best, struggling to earn her daily visit with Brandy and Stassi. The women were quick to correct her mistakes, but she sensed that they were not hostile. They liked her as well as they could have liked any stranger thrust into their closed society, and they were as kind as custom allowed. The closed car had gone an unknowable distance, far enough for Brunn to feel mildly nauseated, when it stopped finally. Someone outside opened the door. A tall woman, the first woman she had seen on this world, reached in and grabbed her arm.
Come on, you! Get out of that!
Brunn struggled up and out of the car with difficulty, not helped by the woman's hard grip. She looked around. The ground car looked like an illustration out of one of her father's oldest books, high and boxy. The street on which it had driven was wide, brick-paved, and edged with low stone and brick buildings, none more than 3 stories tall. The woman yanked at her arm, and Brunn nearly staggered.
No time for lollygagging. You don't need to be sightseeing. Get yourself inside the house like the decent woman you ain't.
Brunn could not move fast enough to satisfy the woman, even with one of the men helping. She was too big, too awkward, and the stones of the front walk hurt her feet. She glanced up at the building they were urging her towards and nearly fell up a stone step. But she had seen it. Made of heavy stone blocks, it had no windows on this side, and beside the heavy door was a tall, stout man who had the body language of every door guard Brunn had ever seen.
A prison?
It might as well have been, she found when she was inside.
Since you're an ignorant little outlander slut and you don't know what decent folks know, listen up and listen good. You're pregnant and you ain't married. That makes you a slut. You're gonna stay here with the other sluts until your baby's born and for a few weeks after that. You're gonna cook, clean, and sew. You will be silent like all the others. You are here to listen, not talk. If I catch you whispering or lip-speaking with other women, you'll be locked in your room for a day.
With that, the matron pushed her into a narrow room with a bed and a small cabinet beside it and shut the door on her. Brunn sagged onto the bed.
And no sitting on the bed during work hours. We don't put up with laziness here. Get your sewing basket. You got plenty to do.
She pointed at the cabinet. Brunn heaved herself up and opened the door. Inside was a round basket and a pile of folded cloth.
Decent clothes for yourself, first of all. Now come along to the sewing room.
She led the way along a stone-floored corridor to a room that opened on an interior court. 5 pregnant women sat busy at their handwork. None of them looked up. Brunn could not see their faces until she was sitting down herself. One had a wry face, pulled to the right by some damage. Brunn could see no scar and wondered what had caused it. But the warden tapped her head with a hard finger.
Hey, get busy, you! Less looking, more sewing.